I'm going to continue till 11:45, and then we will pause. But I wanted to get at least the impediment, because it was a special request. I wanted to lay this out for you to get the to get you thinking about this, because it's a very important thing. It deals with sexuality, family, morality, and your priests. You have to have an understanding of these matters. And it may seem complex, but fathers, you have to take the time to understand this. If I can understand it, you can understand it. If I can apply it as a priest, you can apply it as a priest. So please, I will make available resources to you. I will chart out the baptism for you. I will do whatever Sayedna asked me to do, I would be glad to do. And we also have Father Rabat, who is willing to, he's an expert on marriage. I wrote my doctoral thesis on marriage, Byzantine, and he also wrote his doctoral thesis on focusing on marriage canon law as well, in a very deep way. So there are resources, but I will do some special things for the tools to help you. But like I say at the beginning, the priest has to be the historical theologian. He has to understand these things because he's responsible for this. You have to understand, because if you don't have knowledge about it, and you permit something, like you permit something improper, then you know there's in the you know the old Greek saying, the epitrachilion. There's a Greek slang, petra, the word for stones. Petrachilia, 1,000 stones. If you take your responsibility, you take is very serious, and you can be weighed down like 1,000 stones if you are unknowledgeable and you make wrong decisions. So 1,000 stones. This is very the priesthood is something. I just share something. I was afraid to be ordained a priest, because of the huge responsibility. I was graduating the seminary in 1981. I got married in 85, and it made me pause. Even going to the seminary and studying so hard, because of the responsibility, every single word. One thing struck me when I was a little boy, I wanted to be a priest. I was 4 years old, and I was talking to my mother. And you know what she said to me? She said, I will always remember one thing about the priest. He, by mistake, kicked my father's coffin. And I always remember it. And, you know, it frightened me. Okay? It frightened me. And I share that story with you because it always stayed with me from my mother. How everything a priest does has a tremendous effect on people. Anyway, I'd like to talk now about the consortium for an entire lifetime. That's the second part. So we've talked about a union of a man and woman. That's the first part of the definition. And we were talking about we talked about impediments. Who can enter this union of a man and woman? Now I'd like to talk about this, a consortium for an entire lifetime. This is the second part of the definition of Orthodox marriage. Scripture, Matthew 5:31-19, 3-9, Mark 10:2-12, Luke 16:18, and formal canonical legislation. And we know what that is, the four sources, right? Holy apostles, canons of local and ecumenical councils, and also fathers, patristic texts recognized as having canonical authority. Recognized divorce in the case of adultery, generally defined in canonical commentaries as the affair of a married woman, a definition drawn from Roman law. The illicit relations of a married man are defined as fornication, often in the canonical sources, and are not, according to the Canon 9 of St. Basil, grounds for divorce. Wives instead are counseled to be patient with a fornicating husband, even if such husbands might also physically abuse them through beatings. We certainly don't do that today. but that was a Roman conception. I mention it to you just as a point of reference. If you read canons, be aware of it. But of course, today we regard both as adultery. According to early ecclesiastical legislation, clergy are required to divorce adulterous wives, lest they appear to condone her acts. If they do not divorce, priests and deacons are, according to the canons, to be defrocked. Even if the union is sundered, priests are unable to minister within the church, celebrate mysteries, or perform blessings. They are only able to retain the office of the priest in its outer appearance by retaining a seat with other presbyters during the liturgy and receiving communion with them. Underlying such requirements is a theological view that as a vessel, such priests are no longer capable of adequately transmitting grace as a result of their lives, their sexual contact with their former wife who has committed adultery. At least this is what the commentaries are saying. In some manner, by union with her flesh, they have contracted her impurity and are now considered defiled. I would suggest to you that this type of thinking is confined to that age of Byzantium. We really don't think in these terms, but I mention it to you because it is in the legislation. The marriage legislation of the Cappadocian Father is contained in the formal corpus of Orthodox canon law and expressed in certain canonical writings of St. Basil and Gregory the Theologian, emphasizes the uniqueness of one marriage. God has fashioned unto woman one head, as the church has one bridegroom, an image that symbolizes the mystery of marriage. Nevertheless, Orthodox during the Middle Ages believed that the teaching of the Cappadocians and others similar in their views before them resulted from the conditions of the empire, which permitted divorce by mutual consent. They believed that a fundamental change was brought about in the conditions of society when the Emperor Justinian the Great, who rules from 527 to 565, responded to a request of the church to change the law and restrict divorce through the establishment of grounds, which included not only the illicit relations of the husband, but also others related to fidelity, the maintenance of the marital union, and such as terms of long imprisonment, loss during war, and the adoption of monastic life, eventually incorporated into Canon 48 of the Council in Trullo. The church adopted the grounds for divorce established in Justinian's novels and certain other legislation as its own. Is that a bad thing? No. As I've shown you, there is a way in which we think about the position of the emperor that provides for the fact that the imperial legislation becomes a source for canonical legislation. And I would put it to you that each autocephalous church further developed, changed, and varied these grounds, which were incorporated in canonical works and in canonical practice through the decisions of church courts and holy synods. Considerable bodies of such decisions were collected and preserved. The church performed remarriages for those whose marriages were dissolved in civil and or church courts, depending on whether the state was Christian, Islamic, or secular. The Cappadocian legislation was recategorized to apply to those cases where lay spouses were expelled without divorce decrees. In contrast, for clergy, the old discipline generally remained in force. In modern practice, some Orthodox canonists and churches have accepted a distinction between annulment and dissolution of marriage. But this division does not exist within the Byzantine sources, which contain separate grounds for dissolution of unions formed through blessing or formal betrothal and those by crowning. Within this context, and this is an important point because often we're challenged on this point by Roman Catholics. Within this context, Orthodox canonists do not consider the scriptural passages of Matthew 5, 31 through 32, 19, 3 through 9, Mark 10, 2 through 12, Luke 16, 18, to be metaphysical statements regarding the nature of marriage as an unbreakable contract, but rather moral standards. Certainly, Orthodox theological texts contain affirmations that the marital bond is indissoluble. Nevertheless, there are exceptions made to this moral norm in the canonical life of the Orthodox Church and grounded in a pastoral recognition of the factors of frailty and error that too often concern human life and that result in what? And this is a key point, the spiritual death of a marriage. The spiritual death of a marriage. Although the Orthodox Church teaches that marriage may not be dissolved, this does not mean that such tragedies do not occur. The grounds for ecclesiastical divorce are viewed as instances in which the Church bestows the mercy of God, dissolving marriages, or rather recognizing those whose spiritual foundation has already been destroyed through human frailty, and whose continuance in name alone would result in moral and spiritual harm of the former spouses. As His Eminence Metropolitan Callistus Ware summarizes, since Christ, according to the Matthean account, allowed an exception to his general ruling about the indissolubility of marriage, the Orthodox Church also is willing to allow an exception. And I think we have to understand His Eminence in this context. It's not a metaphysical statement. It is, in fact, a moral standard. And there is such a thing as a spiritual death of a marriage brought about through human frailty that too often characterizes this sinful, sinful life. The Orthodox Church does not, and I want to emphasize this, the Orthodox Church does not have a doctrinal teaching, a dogma, that marriage is an eternal union existing beyond death. Not one canon in the formal corpus of Orthodox canon law or any work of Orthodox canon law contains such a doctrine. This theological opinion held by some circles within the Orthodox Church does not predate the 20th century and originated in the Russo-Byzantine school of theology centered at the St. Sergius Orthodox Theological Institute in Paris. The late, very Reverend Dr. John Meindorf, and believe me, he was a wonderful scholar, a great priest, and a wonderful man. I knew him personally. Of St. Vladimir Seminary popularized this theological opinion. It's a theological opinion in the English-speaking world. Most recently, in setting forth the main points of belief and canonical practice regarding marriage, the common document on the subject produced by the Great and Holy Synod Council contains no mention of marital union as eternal. And I can tell you, I was part of a team of canonists that from Greece, Finland, this country, and all of us were in agreement. There is not one canon that contains such a doctrine, not one. And I need to make this point because that book, Marriage in Orthodox Perspective, or whatever it's by Father John Meyendorf, enjoys a great deal of popularity. But if you trace its editions, you see, you know, the dogma kind of changes as he goes on. You know, it's just, it kind of shifts. And I am not, and I want to make it clear, because sometimes it's we have a certain immaturity about the way in which we discuss theological opinions, in that we associate disagreement in theological opinion with something personal. There is nothing personal in this. Father, I am not enemies with the Meyendorf family or Father Meyendorf. I admired Father Meyendorf. I attended the lecture in which he gave his only scholarly paper on marriage. He has one scholarly paper. It was Dumbarton Oaks. It was published by Dumbarton Oaks. Wonderful, wonderful lecture. I disagreed with him. We had a discussion together right after the paper in Dumbarton Oaks. Nothing, we did not hurl insults with each other. We were arguing over texts. This is a big, this is something we must, I want to make clear here. I believe that this is not a teaching of the church. It is contained in not one canon of the church, that marriage is eternal. And it is not mirrored in any of our practice, canonical practice. And I want to discuss, if I have time, I want to discuss this whole idea of Eucharist as establishing, as being a constitutive element of marriage, which it is not. It is not. Yes. Right, because it's a moral stand. In other words, it's not. We must understand these things. That's not a metaphysical statement. It is a hope that they will be married forever. But to think of them as married, is to think of marriage existing in when we are united with God. I can show you a text. I can show you text after text in Byzantine commentary that says the opposite.
Well, I'm just saying the service.
I know the service. Yeah,
I
got it. Like, it is. It is because you're impressing upon people that they should maintain their marriage.
Forever.
Right. They should maintain it for their entire lives. Yeah. Right, I know Meyendorf, it doesn't match our canonical practice. We allow for divorce. It doesn't. If this is a dogma, why are we marrying people? Why are we marrying people a second time? Why are we permitting this? Why are we allowing them to receive then communion again? As we don't even today, we don't even have the penances of keeping them away from the chalice for 1 to 2 years, okay? They get married a second time after a spouse dies. They receive communion again. When they're not married, of course they're married. They receive communion. And my point about receiving communion is that receiving communion doesn't establish the marriage. Meyendorf is absolutely incorrect. What it is to receive communion is to receive the body and blood of Christ. Fearful thing, fearful thing. But it also is a sign of something else. There's something being said ecclesially. Your ecclesial status. You are in good standing with the church. Excuse me for just a second. You're in good standing with the church, and it says something about your union. If you're in a second union, and you're receiving communion with your spouse, that means this marriage is in good standing with the church. What do you now have? A harem in the heaven? You have two eternal marriages? Silly. Silly. Okay. Sorry. So, let's, can I go on? Do I have your permission to go on?
I have a question.
Yes.
In the canonical manuscripts, is there any evidence that marriage is regarded as something that ends with the death of the spouse?
Is there something that in any...
Does it say that? Does it imply that?
Yes.
Is marriage until death?
Yes, so we have... So let's, if you want an example, I'll give you an example. Okay. So we have Theophylactus of Ohrid commenting on scripture, talks about marriage. And he says that for children of this age, begotten and begetting in this world, marry and are given in marriage. But the children of the resurrection do nothing of the kind, for neither can they die anymore. Therefore, in that age, there is no married life, but instead an angelic and divine life. Here there is marriage because there is death, and there is death because there is marriage. There, where death has been abolished, what need is there of marriage? Marriage is for the help of mortals and for the replenishing of what is lacking, because of death, but where nothing is lacking, what need is there for replenishing?
So what was the relationship between Adam and Eve?
So let's get into, before we get into some theoretical discussion, why don't we pay attention to the texts that I want to go over? Because the texts are rather clear. The texts permit, the texts permit a second marriage, but they permit it with what? With penances. Okay. Now, what might be helpful, I have a case study on second marriage. We should probably do it, because then we're not arguing in the abstract. We're not saying, you know, this father said this and that father said that. We're here to do canon law. So maybe we should look at that text. But I can summarize that, well, maybe I should just bring it up. Would we want to bring it up? Okay. Yeah, hold on. We're going to do one thing at a time. Okay. All right. Let's see. Second marriage is on page 40 for those who have the book. All right. All right, here. Okay. Okay. Here we have three texts. Classic Byzantine text appears in every canon law work whenever we talk about marriages, multiple marriages, second and third marriages. It's a quotation from St. Gregory the Theologian. The first marriage is legal. The second is a concession. The third is a transgression of law. And one beyond this, the life of a swine, which does not even have many of examples of its evil. Okay. It's from a homily, and it is quoted. Notice, the first marriage is what is moral, okay? That is the moral ideal. The second one is a concession. Someone dies, and there's a concession of a second marriage. Why is there a concession? That is our question. So, Matthew of Lestaris, 14th century, canon law encyclopedia, more copies than the gospel during his time, right? Now, he's saying something very authoritative here. However, the divine Paul, who perceived the instability of nature, permitted young widows, if they wished, to enter upon marriage again. That means they're not married anymore, okay? That's what that means. They can't be married twice. That's bigamy, right? So, I mean, they can't be married at the same time. Bigamy. This is digamy. That means successive digamy, okay? If they wish, they can enter upon marriage again. They can have a second marriage. The divine fathers, who were not ignorant concerning the arising of the fleshly spirit, did not deem it fitting to impede those men who chose to marry a second time. However, they did not allow them to have second marriages without criticism. Now, what is the reason that is being given for someone wanting to get married again? Fleshly spirit. It's a natural condition to the human, to us. They want to get married again. They don't want to live life alone. They are attracted to a member of the opposite sex, either a widow or a widower. But the fact that they're being able to marry again means that they can't be married. There's not bigamy going on here. The marriage has ended, but the fact of the matter is, the criticism lies in that they're not able to withstand the discipline of living by themselves. It's being attributed to their attraction to the opposite sex. Now, Nikita of Heraclea, very important figure. He writes one of those pastoral manuals that I was talking about, the questions and answers. Late Byzantine, very popular. What does he say? Strictness does not have the custom of crowning digamous. Remember what I said? They're not bigamous. This is a big distinction. What's the distinction between bigamy and digamy? Bigamy, there are two marriages at the same time. Digamy simply means two marriages after one another, successive digamy. He's talking about digamia, okay? Two marriages. That means one ended, okay? Strictness does not have the custom of crowning digamous. However, the practice of the great church, what's the great church?
Constantinople.
Everyone else is under Islam, right? They're turning to Constantinople because it's not because they're dominating them, but it's because they're in a position to do legislation on marriage, and it's very creative during this period. The great church does not observe such things, but also grants, and this is interesting, marital crowns to digamists. That implies that, you know, we've got to discuss the crowning thing, but I forget about the crown part. Let's look to the part that, in other words, they're recognizing the second marriage. They're recognizing the second marriage as a legitimate marriage. And no one was ever censured in consequence of this, except that they are excluded one or even a second year from divine communion. The point is, though, they're not excluded in perpetuity from communion. They're not excommunicated. They're given a penance because it's a concession, and it deals with not being able to resist the sexual dimension, you know, in other words, to maintain themselves. The motive being attributed to being remarried is based in sexuality. Now, whether you agree with it or not, that is what they're talking about. They're excluded from communion one to second year, but then they're admitted to divine communion. In other words, you're admitted to divine communion. That means it's not only receiving the holy body and blood of Christ, which, again, is fearful, but it also is a statement about your status within the church. To receive communion means you're in good standing with the church, and it says something about your marriage. It is, in fact, put on the same level as a first marriage. After the penance. It has not been approved according to Canon 8 of Neo-Caesarea for the presbyter who blessed these to share a mural with them. Why not? Why not? Because if you maintain the penance, the priest is the one that is imposing the penance on the couple not to receive communion for 2 years, and he should not be involved in the celebration of the banquet because he is actually penancing the marriage. Now, do we do that today? And that's really the question. Have we maintained the penitential system? And it raises an important question about the use of the service for second marriage, because it assumes, if you look at that service, it assumes, first of all, that it is a concession. It is based on the sexual dimension that we all share in our lives, and it assumes that you are, that there is a penance. There is a framework, a penitential framework. Now, I am not making a decision on whether we should use this, whether they should be penance. I know that many places is not there. But I am saying that this is what the canons say, canonical commentary. Finally, just to show you. Yes. Yeah, please, you're say it now.
So if the church,
yeah,
the Anglican church, if the church permits, for some reason, the second marriage, but bishops are not allowed to perform that wedding in the second marriage.
Yes.
This is the penance now.
Yeah. Yeah, and it says something.
To give the dispensation, a blessing to the priest to perform the second marriage, but the bishops are not allowed to do it.
Yes.
This is all based on widows and widowers. I mean, the majority of these...
But what I find is, because you have divorce, the same rules are applying to the divorced.
But I'm saying in the context.
Based on my studies, I can tell you that it is being used that way.
I know, and we are using the second marriage text that is totally based upon the gospel and the tradition of the church, which pertains only to widows.
But the tradition of the church, I'm trying to tell you, the canonical tradition of the church allows for divorce and remarriage of the divorced in the same way as the widowed. So it's not something extraneous, it's together. And this is what you're dealing, you have to face the moral you have to face the moral weakness of the people. So what do you do? What do you do with, like the Roman Catholics? In other words, do you excommunicate them for life?
So why wasn't there a second marriage service for divorced persons or even a third marriage?
Because they didn't see a need. There is a third marriage. The second marriage does double duty for the third. And this is an important thing about the third marriage. Third marriage only receives communion 3 times a year. Why? Why? It's only after periods of Lent. And what are the periods? Nativity, right? Pascha, and Dormition, right? What occurs during the Lent? Not having relations. It's part of the fasting. What does that say about the third marriage? The only time it is considered, if any case could be made about something that does not have good standing within the church, it would be the third marriage, because the marital relations are described as a little bit more as restrained fornication. This is morality. We're talking about fundamental moral principles of family. We're talking about holding the line on what a family is. And I know it may sound unpopular and maybe unpastoral, but it is pastoral. It is very pastoral. Now, the only...
St. John Chrysostom has a teaching about the second marriage and the third marriage.
Yes.
So St. John Chrysostom said the church, you know, like accepted the second marriage and the third marriage in order not this couple to live for fornication.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, like just out of...
Concession. And what we have to argue with the Roman Catholics is that they say, to support their point, they say, well, these are non-sacramental unions. Non-sacramental unions? Absolutely not. The church does not celebrate unmysterious mysteries. You know, the blessings that we give are not meaningless. And we have to defend this point, because what they're trying to say is there is, and they defend it, that they can have a couple that don't live together for 20 years, don't have anything to do with each other, in which all types of havoc have gone on, and they regard them as married. And this is simply not a reality that we accept. And so I end with Joseph of Ephesus, because he's a very interesting figure. He dies right before the Council of Ephesus. And who goes in his place to Ephesus? St. Mark of Ephesus. St. Mark Evgenikos. You remember him? He's the only one that doesn't sign the union. And when the prelates come back to sign the union, they throw silver pieces at them. They sign it like they've been taking the silver like Judas. Anyway, St. Mark of Ephesus is the one that follows him. He died. He would have gone. But Joseph of Ephesus produces one of these questions and answers, and he says, the question is, whether it is necessary for Digamus to be crowned. And he says, this is not suitable at all, except it takes place everywhere. And no one prohibits such an unbecoming act. I only point it out because it's not to endorse it, but to say that there is a lot of variety that is done. And my experience is that it varies from church to church and even parish to parish. Yes?
In the Micron Apologion, Father Michel and I worked on this. That exact answer is given in the page right before the service, or the note on Digam. And then right after it, It speaks about the crowning placed as a concession on second marriage. Just those two items, that's it. It covers the whole thing.
Father, I know that I have to end. I didn't get a chance to cover all the material because I really wanted to get into the relationship of Eucharist. I wanted to discuss the process of establishment of marriage, contract, blessing, and crowning, because there's such a misunderstanding here of the canons. But perhaps we can leave this for another time. I certainly... Okay. This afternoon, I don't think I'm scheduled for anything.
Tonight, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. And tomorrow, I have I wanted to give the lecture on the what I've analyzed in terms of the parish and the regulations of the Antiochian Archdiocese in relationship to the canons. So I will be more than happy to sit with anyone and explain my research on this point and the canons on this point. With regard to formation of marriage, I mean, I lay out the canons on this point in my book on sexuality, and marriage, and celibacy in Byzantine law. It's again cheap. I guess I'm advertising. It's available. All my books are published with Holy Cross Press, the seminary press, and it's available there. If we don't have time to talk about it, and yes. It is available at the Antiochian bookstore. Antiochian. What? It's out of stock. They'll get more in. Todd McIver is in charge, and he does a good job. Sadna, thank you very much.